Separation of church and state. We talk about it a lot in this country. And in the conversation, somebody often points out that that actual phrase does not appear in the Constitution, which is true. But there's plenty of evidence, including the phrasing of the First Amendment, that religion and government are meant to be apart from one another. And we'll get no argument, apparently, from today's guest. Frank Schaefer is an author, filmmaker, blogger, and child of a religious family. He was once part of the religious right, but is no more. He'll speak in Ashland tonight at the invitation of the Jefferson Center. That'll be at 7 o'clock at the Hannon Library on the Southern Oregon University campus. The Jefferson Center is not related to Jefferson Public Radio, but does provide us with some good guests. Frank Schaefer, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Just looking at the list of things you've written, let's see, this is one, your latest book is called And God Said Billy. You've also written Sex, Mom, and God, How the Bible's Strange Take on Sex Led to Crazy Politics, and How I Learned to Love Women and Jesus Anyway. Crazy for God is perhaps one of your best-known books. How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. You've had quite an interesting career.
Yeah, and you know, it's a nice coincidence that we're sitting here talking just after the shutdown ended. And the kind of madness of religious delusion that I have been writing about off and on for the last 20 years while also writing novels. And that, by the way, is the subject of And God Said Billy, which is the anatomy of religious delusion. In that case, about a guy who thinks God's called him to go to Hollywood in the mid-'80s and save it for Jesus. If you look at the motivation of the Tea Party right that has basically been driving us toward this impasse that has just been resolved today and yesterday, you know, really a lot of folks talk about this in political terms, but I don't think you can understand today's politics, certainly not Tea Party politics, unless you understand that the evangelical right wing, of which my family was a part in the 1970s and 80s, not only took over the Republican Party, but themselves have been taken over by a small core group of genuinely radical extremists, in my view. And so really I think that the most recent political stories have actually had an undercurrent of religious fanaticism and delusion about them that a lot of the time the mainstream media seems to miss, almost maybe from a secular point of view, that we're embarrassed to talk about religion seriously. And then on another side, people who are secular or more liberal or moderate in their views don't want to be branded as anti-religious. And so they just don't get into the issue. But that's what I've been wrestling with in this book. But it's also what my own life reflects in my own journey from being the sidekick of an evangelical leader in the 70s and 80s to the present, where I would regard myself as someone who is moderate to liberal in their political views and has changed my own opinions about religion. So, you know, again, it's coincidental, but we just happen to be talking about something that is at the heart of the front page news stories that we're dealing with this morning.
Yes, and in fact, I was going to jump right in there myself because of the fact that you have been, you're being very polite in a format in which you have 45 minutes to talk, but your tweets, I noticed in particular, have been frequent and fairly sharp of late. I mean, you wrote yesterday that the shutdown is a result of 50 years of bad Sunday school.
Correct. 50 years of bad Sunday school and counting. And I think that really, up until the shutdown, I think a lot of people who've been functioning under a kind of a rosy-eyed kind of delusional view of extreme right-wing Christian religion in this country, saying, well, you know, this is something they do in church, and they're a little crazy, and they're waiting for Jesus to come back. And it may infect Mideast policy in that you have people who are interested in the state of Israel and all the rest of it from a point of view of apocalyptic doom saying, but really it's a peripheral issue. But the fact of the matter is when you have somebody like Ted Cruz, there's no way to discuss who he is without realizing that his father's a fanatical right-wing evangelical, that Ted Cruz is a fanatical right-wing evangelical. When people look at these guys staring into a camera after they lost in the Senate and the House saying somehow we won anyway or we fought the good fight, and you're saying what planet are they living on? They are living on the planet of evangelical fundamentalist religion where you can look at your own life not through a lens of fact-based reality when it comes to things like evolution or when it comes to your political views, but you're thinking in terms of spiritual values which then have kind of exploded into the political realm. So really, I say again, the idea that we have to discuss these things on a kind of a level playing field of fact-based reality or politics just doesn't apply to these guys. And I guess some of my blogging on Huffington Post and the tweets you talk about and my novel, And God Said Billy, and the humor that I've got there, I guess, looking at these issues, comes from the fact that, you know, I sometimes have felt like a little bit like a voice crying in the wilderness saying, you better take these folks seriously. They mean what they say. They will bring down our system of government if given half a chance. And up until a couple of years ago, before the Tea Party, people sort of rolled their eyes when I said that. I don't think this morning anybody's going to roll their eyes when I say these people are in deadly earnest. Somebody like Ted Cruz is deadly, deadly serious. And really, they fundamentally are the enemies of our democracy. If they have their way, they will change all of our lives. They will take our economy down with them to prove a point. They will do whatever it takes to get their way. And I think they've showed that as of today very, very clearly.
When you say to prove a point, what is the point you think they're trying to prove?
That America is a godless country headed in the wrong direction, that they're interested in repentance, bringing people to their knees, that they look at the world as a threat. People like the Ted Cruz and the other Tea Partiers see themselves as essentially living in an alien environment, that to quote Sarah Palin, our country has been taken from us. To quote Michelle Bachmann, we need to take America back. Well, from who? Who do you take your country back from in a democracy? You take it back from the people you disagree with. So, you know, my old friend Jack Kemp, during the days when my mother was swimming laps in the Ford White House swimming pool, and we were hanging around with the Kemps and people like Bob Dole and all these other guys in the 70s and 80s, I had friends who were Republicans. Jack called me about 17 years ago when I started writing about the religious right and how it's gone off the rails when I made my own journey. And Jack said, you know, Frank, you're completely right. These folks will take the Republican Party down with them. And he was a conservative. So, I think the issue here is, what does the word conservative mean anymore when, you know, is it Ted Cruz or is it old guys like Jack Kemp who are a whole different kind of person?
It's a whole different range of conservative anyway. We'll talk much more with Frank Schaefer when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. Frank Schaefer and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Frank Schaefer, author of books, fiction and non. He's a filmmaker, he's a blogger, and the child of a religious family, and the guest of the Jefferson Center in Ashland tonight. He'll be talking about the impact of religion on American politics from a former insider of the religious right. That's tonight at 7 at the Southern Oregon University Hannon Library in the Meese Room. And he's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange now. You can join our conversation about church and state separation and how much of separation is good for either one. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, we've dropped a couple of crumbs here we need to pick up and go back and get. Your mother swimming laps in the Ford White House pool. Let's talk about Francis and Edith Schaefer, your parents, and what they
sure.
were all about.
Well, 1947, Dad was a young evangelical fundamentalist missionary. He goes to Europe to help youth in bombed-out cities in a mission effort run by the Presbyterian Church, and stayed. And I was born in 1952 into what then was a little missionary outfit of one chalet, my sisters and me, and a bunch of people sleeping on sleeping bags and cots in the living room, called Le Brie Fellowship, that then grew into a large evangelical-going concern during my dad's lifetime. In 1973, after Roe v. Wade, Dad took a stand against the legalization of abortion and all of a sudden became an intellectual leader and figure in the religious right. So if you talk to someone like Jerry Falwell, who later lent me his jet, by the way, to tour the United States on a speaking tour, he would have told you the reason he got into the anti-abortion movement was because of my father, Francis Schaefer. And that gave us access to a lot of folks, Ronald Reagan, Bush Sr. and Jr. later, people like Jack Kemp, Gerald Ford and others. And so my parents were movers and shakers in the beginnings of the religious right, up to the point where the Republicans were using people like my parents, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Focus on the Family, and all these other guys to, as it were, bring them new voters who had previously been apathetic, which was the big trick. It was to
they
bring,
often didn't vote, is that true?
Yeah, it was to bring in blue-collar Roman Catholic voters, particularly in the East Coast, who were incensed about Roe v. Wade And then to bring in evangelicals who hadn't voted, telling them that, you know, Jesus wants you to essentially vote conservative issues. And that's when it began to be apparent that the conservative issues like abortion, gay rights, feminism, and other things would be used as a kind of a litmus test, a quick hand, you know, like handing somebody a note so you could immediately know what side someone was on. They're either for or against you. And that kind of polarization began. So our family was in that. And when my dad died in 1980, you know, back in the mid-1980s, by the late 1980s, I got out of the movement based on the fact that, first of all, I was very personally turned off by the direction it was taking politically. I had gay friends. I was working in the film business, even though I was making movies at that time, documentaries for evangelical causes. Nevertheless, you know, my friends were cameramen and lighting directors and other people, and this was not the crowd that is, you know, your typical Jerry Falwell follower. So even on an aesthetic basis, I was moving away. And then just philosophically watching how the movement went, its kind of harshness and its departure from reality. And then on a spiritual level, realizing that if it all boiled down to saved and lost and people who disagree with you are going to burn in hell forever, this is not something that made sense to me anymore as I became an adult and got out from my parents' sheltered environment of this mission. So I write about how I got out and in a number of memoirs. You know, fast forward to the present, I was one of Arianna Huffington's first bloggers on HuffPost, and I've written, I have my own blogs there, and Pathios.com, which is a new progressive Christian site that I write on, and I wrote a lot about this latest shutdown on there. And then the books, and I've written five novels, the latest being In God Said Billy, which is really my, you know, even though it's a work of humor, it's my most serious deconstruction of the anatomy of the religious delusion that basically wrecked the first part of my life and I think brought us to the brink of complete catastrophe in the last 3 days because of what the Republicans have done with the shutdown and all the rest of it.
You bring up a really interesting point, though, which is the way that people identify, not just themselves, but others as well. In fact, probably more often others than themselves by single issues,
right,
or a flock of issues. As you pointed out, just as you were saying, abortion, gay rights, and feminism, I'd written down the first two.
Right.
But what happens then is that it is much easier now for people to pull on us and them.
Yes.
Than it used to be prior to things like Roe versus Wade.
Yeah, and the sad thing is today, and this is where a guy like Jack Kemp, who was a good personal friend of mine, was a different sort of conservative. You could disagree with him on policy, but the point was it was about policy. It wasn't about whether you're going to die and go to hell because you disagree with our platform. And it wasn't about you're an evil person and an agent of the devil because we have a differing opinion. It was about policy. And they both started with a baseline of similar facts. So Jack, with his trickle-down economics and his supply-side theories, would have interpreted those facts differently. But today's breed of right-wing Republican, of the Ted Cruz variety, the kind of delusional thinking that I talk about in God Said Billy, is a different thing. It's not about policy. It's about a religious sort of judgmentalism. It isn't we disagree on issues and so we now can meet in the middle. They would no more compromise with you, and I think this is a point secular people in particular just don't get. They would no more compromise with you than they would over their theological issues. So basically trying to talk them into compromise on anything, they bring a kind of rabid intensity to it that the most theologically committed Christian would bring to, say, the issue of whether Jesus is the Son of God. So, what you would call an ordinary, normal kind of thinking person who's trying to deal with these folks doesn't understand that you're dealing with people who essentially have the same philosophical intensity as suicide bombers do. They're not doing what suicide bombers do, but you're not talking them out of anything because logic has nothing to do with it. This is commitment to politics with a religious level of fervor, but more than that, with a religious level of absolutism in which there is never middle ground because it's a question of doctrine.
So there's no compromise.
No,
period.
Because they look at economics. They look at things like immigration policy. They look at issues of women's rights. They look at gay rights and gay marriage. They don't look at these things as policy issues. They look at them as extensions of theological doctrine. And therefore, when you go into these fights, you have to understand that you're dealing with people who are working from an entirely different framework than you are, almost as if you were, you know, you're speaking English to someone who only speaks Mandarin. That's about the level of success you will have in trying to find middle ground.
What I'm trying to figure out, though, is, and you call some of these people the evangelical fact-free Taliban.
Correct.
America and the grip of the evangelical fact-free Taliban was a recent quote.
Right.
How do you square up, though, disregard of the facts, and we've heard plenty of speeches, not just in the past couple of weeks, but the past couple of years, with the commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness. Mm. How do you square up the blatant misuse of facts, or the right. senator, for example, who's, I think it was John Cornyn from Texas, said something on the Senate floor, and his office responded, well, it wasn't meant to be a fact-based statement.
Well, you know, given their attachment to biblical precedent, you have to understand that if you read the Old Testament and even to some extent the New Testament, there are the good guys and the bad guys. When you're dealing with the good guys, you have some commitment, mutual commitment to tell the truth. But if you look at the Old Testament, for instance, the Jews invading various people's countries, whether you know, it was Jericho or whatever else, lying is part of the process. So that, you know, when Jericho is going to fall, and they're going to run around the city with their trumpets and blow the trumpets until the walls fall down, the only person saved is Rahab the harlot. She's saved because she agreed to help the Jewish spies tell lies to pagans in order that God's justice could rain down. In that case, it's okay. So there's always two standards here. If they're looking at you as part of the evil, the enemy, on the side of the devil, wickedness, they will do what they need to do to vanquish you or to minimize what you're saying. If you're one of them, then church rules apply. And again, when you divide the human race into lost and saved, it's what you would call imposing the theological paradigm of salvation of the lost and the sinners onto the political process. So they've never looked at Barack Obama, racism aside, which, by the way, has been a huge factor. I mean, it's no, you look at the map of where his big opposition comes from, and it's the slaveholding states. So there you go, you know, not just to be blunt about it. That said, the fact of the matter is when you look at how they've regarded his presidency as illegitimate from the beginning, aside from racial issues, they've never even accepted the legitimacy of his presidency. Why? Because in their view, having believed some of their own lies about him as well, in terms of him being a Muslim and all this other craziness, they've never accepted the legitimacy of a process that would elect someone who, from their point of view, represents them, that they aren't us. This is the other America. So that when Sarah Palin was running around saying, you know, we're the real Americans, her opponents were stripped of the respect of being Americans, even, let alone, you know, equal citizens and so on. So I just don't think that you can approach these folks on any other level of, A, looking at the level of religious delusion they operate under. On all sorts of things, global warming, evolution, all the rest of it. And then secondly, you have to understand that they are playing a political game, but in their heart of hearts, they consider themselves to be reformers who are proselytizing for religious values, and they're trying to make other Americans like them. And without looking at that, we can never have a really honest discussion about what this phenomena has become.
Frank Schaefer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, author of fiction and nonfiction books, filmmaker, former member of the religious right. He says he got better. He'll be talking about God and politics tonight at a lecture at Southern Oregon University's Hannon Library at 7. You can talk to him here now, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. Michael in Mendocino, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Well, good morning. Mr. Schaefer, is it... A lot of your, what I've heard so far from you, parallels what John Lamb Lash wrote in his book, Not in His Image, which equates religion as a virus that's literally overtaking the world. So are you familiar with his books? And the second question is, how much of this virus has infiltrated the military? And of course, I'll take my answers off the air.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, I'm not familiar with his books, but of course there's been all sorts of contentious issues of civil liberties within the military, where you have evangelical chaplains in all kinds of places like the Air Force Academy using their captive audience literally in boot camp to proselytize. By the way, footnote, since you brought it up, my son John served in the United States Marine Corps, fought in Afghanistan twice, once in Iraq, came back, thank God, in one piece, and lives across the street from me with two beautiful grandchildren and his wife. But part of the battle here, where you see the hypocrisy from the right, is the fact that, you know, they've wrapped themselves consistently in the flag, and yet when it comes right down to it, have used things like some of the chaplaincies within the military to proselytize and propagandize through, and have also interpreted our wars exactly as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda said they were interpreting them, and that is as holy wars. So you've had a level of trying to use the cover of U.S. military intervention in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, even at the level of risking our own troops, where you find crazy things happening, and that is tracts being passed out, people using the cover of our military there in these conflict areas for missionary outreach and so on, exactly the kind of thing that stirs up problems. So there is a connection.
Let us take another call. Ann and Eugene, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Frank Schaefer.
Thank you. I think there's another strain running through the Republican Party, and that's the 1968 Southern strategy, in which after the civil rights laws and the voter rights laws were passed in the mid-60s, that the Nixon campaign went after the bigots in the South who did not accept racial equality and were doing everything that they could, and that's persisted, so that the last 45 years, everything the Republican Party has done has been in the service of billionaires and bigots, and that this religious strain also fits with that, because this evangelical thing all comes out of the South. They're still fighting the Civil War 150 years later.
Ann, thank you for that. Appreciate it. Frank, your thoughts?
Well, Ann, you know, you have just rewritten half of my op-eds for the last 10 years. You and I are totally on the same page. And, obviously, if you look at the Obama presidency, and by the way, I'm a big fan of the president. Every president deals with the hand he's been dealt. And boy, what a hand this brave, compassionate, decent, level-headed, quiet man has been dealt. It just stuns me, the accomplishments of the Obama presidency in the light of the obstruction that he has faced, which is really unprecedented in my lifetime. It goes way beyond, you know, I'm 61, so it's not a very long lifetime, but I've never seen anything even close to this. And, of course, race is the issue. And so, yes, indeed, the Civil War keeps being refought, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And the lies that you've had told about this president by the birthers and other people are inexplicable, other than the color of his skin. There is no way around that.
But lies were told. I mean, you remember the whole, like, you know, Vince Foster didn't commit suicide.
Sure.
Hillary Clinton was involved. So it happened to the last Democratic president, too.
But yeah. The only thing is, where I get off the boat, I totally agree with what you just said. It happens to the last Democrat, and of course in reverse too. Plenty of nasty things were said about George W. Bush that may not have been true. But I think where you really see it, it's interesting. I was watching a number of things on MSNBC the other day where they were sort of congratulating Tip O'Neill in hindsight for his working with Ronald Reagan and the way he knelt by Ronald Reagan's gurney after Reagan had been shot and how this is the way it should be and so on. And I kept wanting to jump in and shout, yeah, they were both white Irish guys who were used to seeing running this. You know, there's no way to duck this. Warm, fuzzy memories about how Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill worked together, as if we can learn something from this in terms of white Southern bigots who come from the evangelical background but also a racialist background. But then have looked at this whole thing like, Congressman, what is it? I keep saying Yo-Yo, but I think it's Yoho from the 3rd District in Florida. When he says, well, you know, the shutdown, they asked him on an NPR program, an interview, is the shutdown a good idea? And it seems to be hurting the economy. And he says, look, I know in my own heart that it's okay. Well, that's kind of religious speak of how you know Jesus is your friend or you've been saved, you know it in your heart. So you combine this kind of squishy, sentimental approach to facts that come from the evangelicals with a sort of an ugly undertow of racism that's always denied, and you have a real mess. And it isn't like other presidents. Yes, there were nasty things, there were lies told, there always are. Politics is a mess. That said, I think Barack Obama has faced something that is unprecedented in our country's history. And we're going to look back at this period and I think see him as a very brave, pivotal figure who like the first black athletes who stepped out on a baseball field, what's remarkable about him is what has he not said, and that he has not risen to his own defense by just pointing the finger and letting it rip. And I just think his forbearance has stunned me. I'm in such great awe and admiration of just that aspect of his presidency.
Let us take another call. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Frank Schaefer.
Yes, does your idea of separation of church and state extend to and include not allowing ministers to be licensed by the state to perform marriages, but have the state perform all marriages and then ministers of whatever religion
bless them in that within that religion.
So, in other words, split up the marriage license part of things and the religious ceremony part.
That's correct.
All right, thanks for that, Mark.
Well, Mark, that's an interesting point because that's exactly how my own wedding was done in Switzerland at age 17 and 18 when I got Jeannie 43 years ago pregnant as teenagers in a fundamentalist evangelical community, no less. So that was an interesting thing.
Boy, no kidding.
But we got married in Switzerland, and the Swiss are not known as left-wingers. You know, it's a pretty capitalist country where everybody hides their money. There's a state church and all the rest of it. But like many European countries, they did extend it to that, so that actually you couldn't just get married in a church. You had to get a secular civil license in the local community. And then if you wanted a church wedding or skydiving, it was all one to them. But that was just the cherry on the cake. The wedding was a civil ceremony, and that was the legal aspect of it. So indeed, there's a lot of places where that's been the case. Here in this country, you know, I don't think that's a big issue, but it's certainly one that other people have thought through.
Much more to talk about. A few more calls yet to take. We are talking to Frank Schaefer here on the Jefferson Exchange about church and state separation, religion and politics, and more. And we'll take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with Frank Schaefer in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. Our guest is Frank Schaefer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Frank Schaefer is one of those people who goes to parties and talks about God and politics. But he's talking about that generally throughout his life in books, in nonfiction and fiction, for that matter, also making films. And he was a former insider on the religious right. He'll be talking about the impact of religion on American politics from a former insider of the religious right. That'll be a lecture tonight at 7, sponsored by the Jefferson Center in Ashland. That'll be at the Southern Oregon University Hannon Library this evening. You can join us here now on the Jefferson Exchange. A couple of phone lines left, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to George in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Frank Schaefer.
Wow, we need more of this. Just the awareness of where some of the information or the impetus comes from to give us a direction. Sir, are you aware of Sinclair Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here?
Yep. Yeah.
And the other one is the fact that, back to the religion, there was a prelate of some kind, I don't know, in the Catholic Church centuries ago, who said, give me the child and I'll give you the man.
Right. That was one of the Jesuit fathers. I forget his name, but yes, you're right. That's the quote.
And then Hermann Göring took it to the next level, in which what he did is he found a almost comic character, a corporal, who he deified, and the rest of the country followed through back to what's known as Kristallnacht.
Right.
And I certainly mispronounced that.
Kristallnacht, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, when you look at these things, there are some areas where you can see very clearly that, you know, we face some of this, give me the child and I'll give you the man phenomena. You know, the whole homeschool movement is really divided into two camps. And of course, there's gray areas in between. One camp is just interested in educating their children well. And it includes all kinds of people, Jews, Christians, secular, agnostic, atheists, and all the rest. They're very sane. You can disagree or agree on philosophy of education, but they're in it for their children. There's another camp that's very distinct in this country, and that is that homeschooling is about retiring to a fortress where essentially the purpose of it is to deprive your children of information. Geology scares you. Biology scares you. Sexual relations between men and women scare you. An interpretation of American history that isn't strictly told from, you know, the point of view of the most fundamentalist Puritan scares you. And so we have actually within our country now, very much coming out of the religious right again, enclaves that are like almost little fortresses of individual families or individual communities or Christian schools and so forth who have really withdrawn. And I think part of the phenomena of why the media was caught flat-footed by people like Ted Cruz and really didn't understand the force with which he was going to parachute into the system was that quietly, you know, the homeschool movement, evangelical churches and others have essentially produced a nation within the nation which you know, looks at life around them in completely different terms than other Americans do. And so that passion, that religious fervor, that evangelical zeal that they bring into politics, that lack of fact-based reality. You know, as I think I had a little quip like this at the end of one of my blogs, and I, you know, back when the polls were starting to go south on the Tea Party over this, I said, you know, 73% of the American people in the latest poll are shown to believe that this shutdown is the fault of the Republicans. The rest believe that there were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark. And, you know, basically, that's the picture. And okay, I did it as a little tweet, but that tells the story. It's not about politics. It's about a kind of a religious, non-fact-based reality that's withdrawn. And, you know, that's it. That's, you know, that tweet basically has everything the New York Times needed to write much better editorials about what was going on, if they only would understand that.
So if people subscribe to your theory that it is really about a religious fervor being applied to politics, how does an opponent counter that?
By telling the truth about it, instead of playing this game that the right plays when they pretend, oh, no, we're just interested in policy. Same thing they do with race. Oh, no. You know, the fact that there's an overlay of the map of the slaveholding states with the people who have produced these white, Republican, bigot congressmen, oh, that's just a coincidence, even though it's 100% of a coincidence. They do the same thing on policy. Oh, no, we're not interested. This isn't about Christianity. This isn't about moral values. This isn't about our litmus test. You know, we're just trying to do this for the good of the economy. And I think simply by honestly calling people on that and saying, no, it isn't. It's about a non-fact-based religious type of existence where you have entire communities of homeschoolers and others that are producing virulently anti-American young people who don't trust anything that they hear or read that doesn't come from one of their own sources, which is always the sign of a kind of a cultic phenomena. If information is suspect that comes from neutral sources, it can only come from your source, you know you're in trouble. And that, by the way, in this novel, In God Said Billy, and I'm an author and I earn my living that way, so yes, that was a plug, speaking of being honest.
Right.
But, you know, people who read that book and are writing reviews on Amazon and so forth are getting it. And that is that unless you investigate the phenomena of religious delusion, you will not understand the period of history we're living in. It's as simple as that. This is not a side issue. This is a big deal.
9 minutes left and 5 phone calls. Let's see how many we can take for Frank Schaefer, starting with Al and Eugene. Welcome. Sorry, I got the wrong one there. Let's go back on hold. Let's go. Al and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I would like to ask your guest the relation between these groups and, let's say, the settlers in Palestine and the annexation of Palestinians' home and civil rights and human rights. And I heard one time one commentator who was critical of this, who was saying they both are the Christian rights and the settlers, they both are fooling each other. I'd like to hear your comment about that.
All right. Thank you, Al.
Well, Al, you know, you've touched on a subject which I have written about. And actually, it's not a coincidence that my delusional figure in And God Said Billy, who's named Billy, winds up actually having to deal with this because he's in South Africa in the 1980s. And one of the people he gets in trouble with is a South African cop who basically explains to him that he's a traitor, that America is a traitor to God's people because they're not supporting the apartheid regime of South Africa. God called the Afrikaners to settle. He makes a comparison with the settlement of the Israelis into Palestine. He compares that to the first settlers in the United States, the Puritans, coming into the Bay State colony. And indeed, if you read the literature of people like John Hagee in Houston with a 50,000-member church who talks about welcoming the apocalypse because Jesus is coming back and so basically looks at Mideast politics through being on the side of the State of Israel come what may, all because it fits in with his apocalyptic view of the end times, which people like Michel Bachmann believe we are in and so on. Yes, this is all tied up in one horribly neat little package of simplistic thinking. And of course, the people who have paid all through history, there's a group of colonial folks who come in and decide that they are not the chosen people, but they are and take their land and on. The United States has a great experience with this with our Native American community. It's happening on the West Bank right now with every new settlement that's being built, and it's happening across the globe in terms of a lot of our policy, which when it came to people like George W. Bush was driven by a kind of a right-wing fanaticism that has a lot of relationship to the same thinking that went into the colonial process on the West Bank. So, yeah, it's all part of a package. These things are very related. And again, I don't think most people realize how religiously fanatical some of the right-wing Republicans are when it comes to things like support for, you know, our military intervention in the Middle East based on the wackiest ideas of end-time prophecy. I mean, it's hard to even talk about this on the air because it makes you sound crazy to even bring it up. But trust me, it's actually real. And there are people functioning on that basis.
Short question, short answer. Jacob in Gold Hill wants to know if there's one book of yours that best states your major points today.
Well, in terms of today's discussion and God Said Billy, in terms of my biography, Crazy for God, which is a memoir.
Okay, Crazy for God and God Said Billy, which is the one. And God Said Billy is the fiction book just out now.
Right.
Let's go to Tammy in Albion, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Frank Schaefer.
Yes, I wanted to... well, the first question was kind of answered, how then shall we live? But the second question is, are there absolutes? What's your position on this?
All right. Thank you, Tammy.
Well, you know, and this is going to sound a little glib, and I'll take a second to unpack it. So forgive me for a short answer at first. But, you know, I think that certainty is the enemy of truth. Because the minute you no longer see your life as a journey or your conclusions as what you believe today, but maybe tomorrow you could learn something different, you've closed your mind to the spiritual path we're all on as we grow. I'm having that illustrated every day to me now with my 5-year-old little granddaughter, Lucy, and my 3-year-old grandson, Jack, across the street, noticing the quality of my being a grandparent. I'm such a better grandparent than I was a young teen father. This is the same guy, I guess you could do genetic tests and I'm the same person. But I literally wouldn't know this kid if I met him. That's life journey. And that goes for politics. It goes for religion. It goes for relationships. And so words like absolutes are nonsensical when they're used to freeze time. And of course, that's why a lot of pastors are just pulling paychecks who don't really believe what they believe anymore when they were zealous 23-year-olds, certain of everything. Now they're 60-year-olds. They're a little wiser. They know that those certainties don't stand up to time. Wise people move along on a journey. So, yeah, I do have an absolute that I believe in. And that is, I believe I will change my mind about things I am saying right now on the air and learn something from them and people's responses. And I'm open to that change.
Let's take another call from Judy in Williams. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Frank Schaefer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a delightful topic. I'm going to have to get all your books. I was raised kind of like you were, although not in the big public spotlight, in Wyoming. And whatever people say about the Deep South, I encountered there in Wyoming, too. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I wanted to comment on was I was persecuted because I was called Judy Go to Church because I was out trying to save everybody's soul, and because I thought that was expected of me. I accepted that persecution because I realized since then that the people that taught me Sunday school, they have a self-isolation going based on the fact that the church has always been persecuted, or so they say. And so they don't really care about what the heathens out there think. We were isolated. I didn't care. I go to Sunday school. You're such a good girl. I go to school. I was ostracized. But I didn't care until I started looking and seeing what was really going on. My dad took me aside and says, hey, take a look at this stuff. And he showed me some other things. And I thought, wow, this is just, I got to get out of here. So I did. But I really do understand how these people can, you know, Sarah Palin and Ted Cruz can slap each other's backs. And, you know, everybody's like sticking up for each other in that group. And they don't care.
All right.
I try to tell people not only do they believe it, they don't care.
Yeah, you make a great point.
That's my comment.
All right, Judy, thanks for that.
Well, that's incredible insight because right there is the key to understanding why these guys look so pleased with themselves when they lose. This is the martyr victimology complex. They are doing God's work. Their heroes are people who are taken to heaven in fiery chariots, who lose on earth but gain in heaven. They see things in terms of not just the apocalypse, but personal apocalypses. So that Ted Cruz is very pleased with himself, and he has more Tea Party support than ever, having just taken them down to ruin. And other politicians in the Republican Party who were what you might call normal, sane people look at him and say, how could you do this? Don't you see what's happening? He sees exactly what's happening, and it's what you said. He's going out and being persecuted by pagans for taking a stand. That's how he would see it. So not only do they have a strong sort of victimology, they glory in their victimhood. They glory in being, you know, as they would see someone like me taking them on, they would glory in that and think that this is sort of toe-to-toe warfare with the devil is the way they're looking at it. So good luck with trying to talk them into any compromise.
And Ed and Eugene writes, our whole existence revolves around opposites, so gird up and fight for your ideology because the other side will. John Notown Givens says, I think the religious political environment your refreshing guest is describing comes down to one thing, education. If you overlay a map of educational levels and achievement with a map of political trends and religious trends, they are very much in alignment, especially on a county-by-county basis. I'd be curious what your guest thinks of this thesis.
Well, I think the same thing as the overlay of the maps of the right-wing states that take far more from the national treasury than they put in compared to the so-called left-wing states, you know, full of bleeding-heart liberals that actually are the ones who are earning the money in this country to pay for the entire system. I mean, all these overlays of maps tell you something that's very different from what the Tea Party is telling you. And again, these facts don't seem to matter to these people because their victimology, what your previous guest caller was telling about in terms of her own childhood, that the more she was persecuted for being, you know, your evangelical witness out there, somehow the more right she felt about it. And this is how these folks are functioning. And I just think that a secular mind or someone moderate or a progressive Christian, progressive evangelical, Roman Catholic, you know, all these different kinds of people simply don't get the fact that the folks that they're trying to discuss policy with aren't interested in policy. To them, this is a kind of a religious crusade. And I think one of the little sub-stories, and I know we don't have time to get into it here, but just a note that I'll leave you with, is that I think this experience of this near shutdown and catastrophic kind of economic Armageddon we almost face is going to be one of those watershed points when you look back and say, why did evangelical Christianity lose its popularity in this country? This will be a moment when people will look back and say, yes, yeah, something changed.
Huh. We will see on that one. But we will see Frank Schaefer tonight at 7 o'clock at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University, brought here by the Jefferson Center to talk about his time with the religious right and how he took it all back. Frank Schaefer, pleasure to meet you. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
It's very good to have you. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange, we'll talk about a potential top two primary for Oregon. We'll talk about solar water heaters for low-income Californians. And then we'll talk to the author of the book, Thank You, Anarchy, about the growth of the Occupy movement. All tomorrow on the Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. And have a great day.